Today, I am going to be joined by Grunt Grubbs, aka Eric Grumman, who is also a tactical dietitian who was prior service. So Eric's going to tell you a little bit about where he came from, what he's been doing, and sort of his pathway to becoming a dietitian, why he decided to go down that route, what he's doing now. At the end of today's show, we're also going to be discussing some nutrition myths. I'm Susan Lopez, tactical dietitian, and this is the Tactical Nutrition and Performance Podcast. Welcome to the podcast where we help individual athletes bridge the gap between nutrients, metabolism, sleep, stress, and training so that they can perform better and live longer. Welcome to the show, Eric. I think the last time that we actually got to talk to each other, you were completing internship. And we just had met through social media, which is interesting because I feel like everybody meets through social media these days, right? But we were talking about kind of what you wanted to do with your career. And now fast forward, gosh, I don't know, years later, and we've kept in contact. And I thought this would be a really great opportunity, one, to bring you in, catch up, see what you're doing, but also we want to kind of bring you back to maybe do some more episodes with us as sort of our episode co-host and maybe have some discussions around things that are happening in the nutrition space, especially tactical nutrition. I think that would be a lot of fun. So today is our inaugural podcast where we're going to introduce you to everybody. So Eric, I'm going to let you take it away. Tell us who you are and what you've been up to and give us your short story.
Okay. I will try my best to keep it short. So I'm from Wisconsin originally, born and raised. I went to college for a couple years prior to the Marine Corps. Didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was thinking military, but wasn't sure. Started as a nursing major, made it like one semester, took one anatomy class. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to do this. So I switched to a business degree, but honestly, I think I still just wanted to go to the Marine Corps and I was just doing college to like, you know, appease my parents or, you know, whatever, just not thinking. So I eventually went to the Marine Corps after 2 years of school. I served with 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines, and had a great experience overall. You know, a lot of what I learned in the Marine Corps, I still use today, especially as a dietitian. Met a lot of great friends, had a lot of crazy times. And I always try to keep my military service short when I do intros. If anybody's interested about learning more about like my personal experience in the Marine Corps, I'm always happy to share that. But like, and maybe it's just me, but it's like a personal pet peeve when I read like a military book. It's like the first half is like, especially if it's a Navy SEAL book, it's like the first half is buds. It's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure it's like I've been there now because I've read so many SEAL books and it's all about buds. So yeah, I was in the infantry. We did infantry shit. It was super cool. And then I got done, like, you know, the Marine Corps was just it was going through this big transition. You know, we're leaving Afghanistan. Iraq was over. And there just wasn't a lot of like real life infantry shit going on. So I was like, all right, it's like time for me to get out. So I decided to go back to school. And at that point, I was older. I like to consider myself wiser, but no guarantees. And I started as a civil engineering major because I was like, I want to make money and I'm good at math and science. So I was like, engineering's perfect for me. I just picked civil engineering because I thought, you know, building bridges would be cool, but it wasn't a passion of mine. I was in it for the wrong reasons, essentially. And that's kind of what I found out my second year. So I'd already applied to an engineering program at UCI from the junior college I was at. And I was in this one status class one day and the kid sitting next to me was like, I was like, hey man, how's your weekend? He was like, great. Taught myself like all these computer programs for engineering. And you could just tell he was excited. And I was like, this kid's going to be an awesome engineer. I was like, that is not me. You know, what did I spend my weekend doing? I was meal prepping, working out, surfing, like getting outside, like doing things I love. So in that moment, I realized, okay, well, if I'm going to be in a career for the majority of my life, I want to make sure it's going to be something that I actually enjoy. And over the period of like 2 weeks, I kind of landed on being a dietitian. I was between exercise physiology and nutrition, but my personal passion has always been the food side, I think. Like I've always enjoyed exercise, but eating healthy and seeing what nutrition can do for your performance and cooking, that is kind of like, it was one leg up. And that's what kind of pushed me over the edge to to go the nutrition route. And then going through the dietetics program, I'm like most dietitians in the performance world, I didn't know what to expect from the nutrition program, but I thought it would be way more geared towards performance nutrition and like nutrition in that regard. But there's food service classes and community nutrition and clinical nutrition, and they all have their place and they're awesome in their own regard. But I was like disappointed because I was like, man, that's not like why I joined this field. The clinical stuff's cool. And I'm still a clinical dietitian at the VA. And like, it's a fun side of things, but my true passion is in performance, right? And that's kind of why I started my business.
I think the thing for me is like one of the reasons that I feel like we've connected so well over the years is that while there's a decent amount of dietitians who have served in the military or serving in the military, a lot of them came into the military as dietitians. And
right.
So you and I had a totally different experience, right? We were prior enlisted, got out of the military, and then became dietitians, and in some capacity are now working back for that community.
Yeah, there's a couple that have reached out to me. I know there was like one Marine infantry guy that reached out to me, and I think now he actually also is a dietitian for the military. I'm not sure in what capacity, but at least... And it's tough, right? Because I don't know everybody that's out there. Basically, my you know, scope of knowledge is social media at this point. But I feel like I know a lot of dietitians in the community. And yeah, I completely agree. There's not a lot of people that went from prior service that wasn't related to nutrition and then went into nutrition. Most of the dietitians, I feel like, you know, kind of went into the military as dietitians.
Yeah. So if you're a dietitian and you were prior enlisted, sorry, officers, reach out to us because we want to start a club.
Yes. The prior enlisted, the prior E club.
You get bonus points if you were infantry beforehand.
Yes. My dogs.
I love it. Oh man. So you're working for the VA now. Tell us a little bit and doing your private practice, but tell us a little bit more about your private practice, Grunt Grub. What's it about?
Absolutely.
Who do you serve? You know,
yeah, it's actually transitioned over the past couple of years. So when I first had the concept of Grunt Grub, you know, my passion and my ideal client is the tactical community, whether that's firefighters, police officers, military. Those are the guys that I best understand because I was one of those guys. And I still am that guy, you know, in terms of my personality, my interests, the way I exercise. I mean, I just gave myself rhabdo, if that tells you anything about me. So,
I totally forgot about that. Yeah, we can touch on that briefly. Yeah, we're going to talk about that.
So like, I get that. And those are the guys that, you know, I have the most passion to serve. So Grunt Grub was really geared towards that. However, at the same time, you know, my idea of what a grunt is has also changed a little bit because having friends and family that have been in the trades their whole life and whole career, like those guys are grunts to me too. Like the lineman that goes out and makes sure the power's on in the freaking, you know, at 2 a.m. in a thunderstorm, like that guy's hardcore. He's a badass. And I've got passion for that too. I actually, as a part-time job, just to make a little extra money on the side, I install solar panels, you know, 14-hour days, working out of a cooler the whole time. It's physical labor. And I really enjoy it. But it's almost like market research for me because I feel like I can really understand then a day to day. And I actually did that job pretty much full time last year for some extra money. But it gave me such good insight into like what that demographic or that type of grunt needs in terms of nutrition. Because man, when you're stuck to, you know, you have no microwave, no refrigerator, very limited equipment capacity. Yep. Like you got to be super creative to like keep your diet diverse and well-balanced and find time to eat healthy, not to mention exercise around that. So Grunt Grub is all encompassing, all grunts of the world. So it started with a tactical focus and now it's kind of just men in the trades.
In addition to dietetics, right? Clinical, Grunt Grub, and then your solar panels. Like you're also like an avid hunter, fisher, outdoorsman as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just on a run with one of my buddies and we were talking about this as it relates to social media. So I grew up hunting and fishing. It's been a huge part of my life ever since as long as I can remember. Like my grandfather took me out when I could barely, like just started walking, would take me deer hunting. So I've been in that, like doing that for as long as I can remember. And I absolutely love it. Like when I was in the Marine Corps, I wasn't back in Wisconsin. I was busy, obviously, with like, you know, going to the field, being deployed. So like, I didn't get to hunt hard for like that 4 years. And I really, really missed it. So like moving back to Wisconsin from California, I dove right back in and I freaking love it. Like, it's so hard to put into words, but to put it simply, I feel like it allows me to connect with my most primal self. Like it is, it's in my blood and DNA. It feels so natural for me to be in the woods as a predator. And then when you harvest an animal, like an elk or a deer, or even a turkey, like being able to take that animal down, like the emotional experience that's attached to it, along with then taking care of and processing the animal yourself, and then eating that food and letting your family eat that food. I mean, it is awesome. I think Steven Rinella and the Meat Eater crew, they do a really good job in their Netflix series and their TV show and everything that they do, basically showing that side of it, you know, because growing up, the hunting videos I watched, it was all just brand advertisements and the kill and blah, blah, blah. But like Steven Rinella, he really understands like the everything that goes into the hunt, the scouting, the actual hunt, the processing, and then the meal that comes after, because that's what it's all about, is getting food. And to me, it's the best food on earth. Like to me, there is, in fact, after this podcast, I'm cooking venison backstrap tonight. You can check my Instagram out. It's going to be fire. I'm freaking pumped. But yeah, I love it. And like in a perfect world, if I didn't have to, you know, pay bills, I would be hunting and fishing every single day and foraging for, you know, mushrooms and various, you know, plant foods out in the forest to build my plate. Like I love everything about it. I think he was sick, and then he might've tried crossing a river. No.
What do you think is the most challenging hunt that you've been on?
The most challenging hunt? Mm-hmm. I'd say physically, the elk hunt I did last year in Wyoming was by far the physically the most challenging hunt I've done, because it was like 90 plus degrees and we were covering at least like 12 to 13 miles in the most inhospitable terrain I've ever walked in. Like it beat anything I did in the military. We were blazing our own trails. It wasn't like you were walking on nice stuff. It was freaking wild. And then when we actually shot an elk, we were at a different spot and we had to hike that thing out like 7+ miles.
Yeah.
It was brutal. And then we had a storm front roll in and it went from 90 degrees down to 20 degrees in like a matter of 7 hours, and it snowed that night. So like the whole thing was just crazy.
I'm sorry. Did you say 90 degrees to 20 degrees?
Yeah. Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah, like I slept in, I didn't
even
bring a
sleep. How do you plan for that?
You just like, that's a mistake I made. Like I have been in the mountains a lot and I know better. But when I went out on our first, like, you know, 4 day trek, I was like, I'm not bringing a sleeping bag. I looked at the weather. It's 80s and 90s the whole time. I was like, I'm just bringing a bivy sack. I'm going to sleep in that. I'll be fine. And then we checked our Garmin InReach and it was like storm front rolling in, temps getting down like 20s to 30s. I was like, oh shit. I got really lucky because we were already planning on heading back that day. But if I would have been out there and I didn't have my sleeping bag, like tough luck, I would have had to just figure it out. So you have to really like, you have to bring all the right stuff. You've got to plan for contingencies. Like it's just like meal prepping. You always have to plan. You got to think ahead, think of every possible thing that could happen and have a backup plan.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy to like get back to base camp and wake up the next day to snow.
Wow. That's amazing. So how do you prep for something like that? Right. So I've actually, where I work, and I've definitely worked with guys who are prepping for some of those hunts. I had a guy that I was working with recently, just did a big 11-day trip. And he came to me pretty early on and we like got kind of like his hydration and his fueling strategy together. But I want to hear from like you, who is actually a dietitian and hunter. I want to see how close we are.
Yeah. So I know that doesn't seem very organized and I apologize about that, but like, the moral of the story is when you're burning that much, it's a balance between how much I can carry and how much I can physically shove in my face. Because the worst thing you could do is become deficient in electrolytes and cramp up, or be underfueled and then just be dragging. Like, I'm not worried about gaining excess weight when I'm out there. Like, I'm worried about losing weight. Like, there's no way you're going to gain weight on something like that. You just can't physically carry enough food for 5 days.
And I'm always surprised by the amount of guys that I work with who are like on mountain teams or like who go out and do those kind of things. And they're like, kind of like that weight versus carrying fuel algorithm that they do in their head, and they're like, well, is it really worth it? And so, like, I'll talk with these guys and I'll be like giving them my suggestions. I'll be like, look, like the standard suggestion for a movement like that is a gram of carbohydrates for every minute that you're moving, essentially, right? Now,
Yeah.
that's like the ideal situation, but most guys aren't going to hit that, right? And so you kind of have to break it down into simpler things, like, aiming for like 60 to 90 grams per hour, right? Which comes
Yep.
out to essentially the same thing. You just get them to take like whatever you can. And some guys will take it and they'll be very diligent about it. I had a team recently who did a training exercise up in Mount Rainier. And so some of the guys were like, I'm just going to do it to bleed. And I'm like, okay, well, good luck. Godspeed. And then there were other guys on the team who were like very diligent. Like they actually like counted everything out and they had it baggied and they like had a strategy and they practiced with it like a few weeks before they went out so that they could tolerate it while they were moving. And I think that's another mistake that people make is they don't practice with it and they think they're just going to implement it and it's going to be fine. And then they start trying to get in like that volume of fluid, electrolytes, and carbohydrates during a movement and they haven't practiced with it. And then it just becomes a shit show, right? Sometimes,
If you're not used to simple carbohydrates or just solid food when you're moving, because people don't realize, anything intra-workout, like especially during movement, like running, hiking, like your blood is not diverted to your stomach. Like digestion is not a priority. Like keeping your legs moving is the priority. So if you're eating a ton of abrasive things, high fiber, even high fat while you're moving, it's going to cause GI upset, especially if you're not used to it, because your body isn't prioritizing digestion at that time. So the way I break it down, that was a great example. And that's what I said, in the beginning, is I compare it to endurance running, because the 60 to 90 gram per hour is very similar to what I recommend for any endurance runner and what I follow myself. I guess, just from it's one of those things that I've been doing it for so long. Like when I pick a meal out for myself or like plan my meals for the day, it's almost intuitive at this point that I'm just like, okay, I know how to balance it. I know I'm going to be like, my priorities are going to be simple and high amounts of carbohydrate, because that's what my body's going to rely on for energy. I know that I don't have a ton of capacity for weight, because every ounce is going to equal a pound at some point. So I'm trying to get nutrient dense foods, like super dense. That's why peanut butter is great, because it's just super high in calories. But I can carry, like, I mean, a tub of peanut butter is just, it's like this awesome calorie source. And it's really not that much weight if you were like to compare it to maybe like a tub of, I don't know, like a thing of, I don't know, vegetable puree, right? Like where it's like you're not getting any calories from that. But yeah, the name of the game is definitely staying fueled and staying on top of it, because when you're out in country like that, it's very dangerous. And if something were to go wrong, like if you cramped up or you fainted or you ran out of food, like there's no one coming to save you anytime soon.
Did you hear that story about that Sherpa? I think they were climbing like Everest and he had to carry down the person he was guiding. I heard that
I
happens all
mean,
the time.
yeah, I mean, even that documentary on Netflix, the 14 Peaks, like that guy had a, he several climbers he had to help carry down. I mean, it's always a good strategy to practice before you go out. Because you don't want, I mean, it's just like on a competition run. Like you don't want to try your fueling strategy day of, because seriously, it can ruin your entire event because your body's not used to breaking it down.
When you're doing a long event like that or a long movement like that, what's your recovery strategy? What is something that you're thinking about as soon as you get back?
Like day of, like, so I'm out, I'm hunting all day, I get back to camp, or I'm back from the hunt.
Both.
So I'd say day of that night, again, I'm pretty limited with my freeze dried, but you have to understand what your body did that day. You broke down muscle because you were hiking around all day. You definitely depleted your carbohydrate stores, because all of your glycogen is going to be gone if you're hiking. I mean, if you've been on top of your fueling, maybe not so much, but my strategy at the end of the night is fill the tank again. So my, calories is the overarching goal. Carbohydrates are a primary focus, and protein is the primary focus. So however I can carry protein out to the field, I'm doing that, whether it's in the form of protein bars, which I like treating myself to, like those builder bars or anything like that. The freeze dried, I intentionally choose ones that have high carbs, high protein. And then when I get back from the hunt entirely, you know, it's kind of R&R. So like giving my body a physical break and focusing on all the basics. When I'm out in the field like that, I'm less focused on, you know, like hitting all of my micronutrient goals and getting this well-balanced, like I'm not eating a ton of fresh fruit and vegetables, right? Because to me, in that week that I'm on the hunt, possibly 2 weeks, that like my priority is performance. And that is solely going to be driven pretty much by, you know, the carbohydrates, recovering with protein and eating enough calories. Like I'll get by without getting high fiber, all the good stuff I can normally eat. So when I'm back, you know, I really prioritize that extra. Like I'm really diligent about getting plenty of fresh fruits and vegetables, like giving my body everything that might've been depleted those 2 weeks I was out there, and then resting my body, hydrating, getting adequate sleep, because sleep out in the field is never that great. All the basics, but just making sure I'm very diligent about it every single day, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another important thing to point out is when we're talking about your protein intake in a situation like that, you should expect that it's going to be lower than what you're going to get like in a home situation, right? If you're aiming for a gram per pound or more, you know, when you're at home, that's not going to happen when you're out there, right? For a couple of reasons. One is because you have to make room for the carbohydrates, right? Mm-hmm. That's going to need prioritized. So if you're carrying it in your pack, if you just don't have the appetite because you're moving, you have to make room for those carbohydrates by cutting out some of the protein. And also just bowel health, right? I think you probably maybe have heard some horror stories about guys that go out to the field and they just protein themselves to death and then they can't take a shit.
Yeah, I mean, that was me in the Marine Corps. Like, yeah. I mean, for sure. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, you know, and I think a lot of men, and I'm sure females too, but like men are just notorious for this. Like the only thing they focus on is protein. And I get it, because like in their minds, it's like protein, muscle mass. Like that link is just so strong. It's like unbreakable. But those carbs are so crucial, like especially when you're going to be moving all day. Like there's nothing worse than not having energy to do exactly what you trained all year to do. Like if you put all your time and money into going on a hunt like that and then back, you want to be topped off, high energy the entire time. Not to mention just your mental acuity. If you're falling short on carbohydrates, you are going to be lacking. Your ability to be a predator and make that kill is going to be lessened because of your nutrition, without a doubt. And for me, like situations like that are always fun because that's the time I can really like go off the rocker with the foods I eat. Like I eat Pop-Tarts and Gushers and, you know, like childhood things that I'm nostalgic about, because like you're so miserable in the heat and the hiking that like the food is something that brings you joy. And at that time, that's like the one time where that food is actually going to benefit you because it's just giving you sugar, which is exactly what your body needs. So it's kind of like a win-win. My diet's super fun when I'm out hunting. That's where I get to eat all those snack foods. Now, when I'm whitetail hunting in Wisconsin, it's a lot different because I'm sitting in a tree stand. So I actually plan food that's quiet to eat. I package it in ways that's quiet, but I also try to still hit all of my nutrition goals. That I'm eating more fruits and vegetables. I'm drinking like the vegetable purees because it's not nearly physically as taxing.
Yeah. And that's interesting that you mentioned that it's got to be quiet. Those deer are skittish.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you know, chewing on something that's crunchy or having a wrapper that's like crumbly, like not good in the tree stand. Like you can't have that, you know, you got to be silent.
Yeah, I don't do a lot of hunting now, but growing up, so I grew up in North Dakota and my dad was a big hunter and my uncles and all of that stuff. And so I was constantly getting like, yes. Oh, I love
that's from North Dakota.
That's awesome.
That's when was that was, I think like 2000 and probably 2000 and maybe. Oh, I got a tag on the horn. Yeah, 2018.
2018. Where was I? Oh, okay. So I was leaving Houston that year. So at the end of 2018, we were leaving Houston to come up here to Washington. Is that right? No.
Doesn't it seem like forever ago?
Oh, fuck yeah. So 2019, we came here to Washington. So end of 2018, I was still in Houston. I was getting ready to give birth. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I hadn't been to North Dakota at that point in probably like at least 10 years. Yeah.
It's a cool spot. That was like my first experience still there. Really exploring. They have moose. I had no idea. I saw moose on the deer stand.
North Dakota is amazing. What? Like you will never see more beautiful sunsets in your life, in my opinion, than you will in North Dakota. And part of that is because it's so open. And in certain parts of the state, you do have like rocky areas.
Sure.
And just the colors that the sky throws is just amazing. Like I've been to a lot of places and I have never seen sunsets or sunrises like that in my life.
Underrated.
Very underrated, just beautiful. I could probably go off on that. But definitely something I didn't appreciate when I left there to join the military, and something that I have a deep appreciation for now. My dad is still there, still living on the farm, still
That's awesome.
farming. Yeah, I keep telling him he should just retire and come live with us, but he swears up and down he'll never leave. Can't
You
blame
know
him.
what? Yeah, for sure. My wife and I's goal, like my ultimate vision, is to have a farm, like just a small hobby farm. I'd like to grow a lot of my own produce. I'd like to have a couple animals, and I'd like it to be surrounded by woods that I can hunt and forage in and then trail run. Like to me, that is everything. A
Same.
simple life.
I would love to do that too. So I know one of the things I want to kind of move us forward. One of the things we were going to talk about today is we wanted to talk about some of these nutrition myths that we keep hearing about.
So I don't know if you could call it a fact, more of a trend, but the carnivore diet, that is the one that I want to hit because it's the one that's most prevalent and the one I get probably the most questions on consistently.
I can
And
hear
like
the zealots knocking down my door already.
I know they pitchforks and torches, they'll be coming tonight. But it's one of these things. And it's always surprising to me when a new diet comes out, how people just jump on board so quickly. Like it has been a thing for as long as I can remember. Every year, a new diet comes out. It's like, this is it. This is the one. But have we not figured out by now that they don't work because a new one comes out every single year? Like it's just crazy to me. And the fun thing is, they just get more extreme. And when I was actually with Brooke West on the Health Unfiltered podcast, and somebody on the podcast had mentioned that it's basically like the antithesis of the vegan diet. It's like the vegan diet came out, and then people like me were like, "Fuck you! Like I'm gonna eat only meat because you guys suck. Like I don't believe in that at all." I mean, seriously, that's what it seems like because it's fucking crazy to me that you could
Oh
cut
my
out
God.
like these huge food groups. And it was fun watching the progression. I mean, fun from an outside perspective. I feel bad for some of these people I'm about to mention, but like watching the progression because it started out, okay, it started out meat only. It included organ meat, which is very nutritious. Like liver is extremely nutritious. Huge fan of liver. I eat liver personally, think it's awesome. I just don't eat it every day, even every week. I have it occasionally.
I mean, okay. So if you don't know, like if you're listening and you don't know, you can actually build up like vitamin A toxicity by
Yeah.
consuming, like the amount of liver the Liver King was consuming was probably enough liver to give you like some pretty serious health issues. Not that he didn't have other issues, but
Absolutely.
like that's a thing.
Not to mention, the liver is what detoxifies the body. So like although there are very beneficial things in a liver, like a lot of minerals, right? There's also potentially some not so good things that are also in the liver. So if you're eating this regularly, it might not be the greatest thing for you, especially considering there are numerous other sources of all of these vitamins and minerals, and you don't need to just eat liver to get them. But the fact that these people started, they only ate meat. And I remember somebody making a post online that like screenshotted one of these like carnivore diet blogs. And somebody had posted, like, "Hey, my gums are bleeding. Anybody else dealing with this?" It's like, yeah, no shit. That's scurvy. We pretty much cured that, like, back when the British sailors discovered that if you ate limes, it got rid of scurvy because they were deficient in vitamin C. And then now the new carnivore diet, as it's now evolved, it's like, okay, well, honey is okay because we need some carbohydrates, and fruit is okay. No, because we need vitamin C because we don't want our followers to have bleeding gums, right? And dying of scurvy left and right.
So any diet, right? To me, it doesn't matter if it's the carnivore diet or the vegan diet. Like if you have to actively, like without a doubt, offset anything that you're missing from that diet through supplementation, then that should be an indicator to you right then and there that that is not how you're meant to eat, right?
Right.
So if you're eating just a fuck ton of meat and you're not getting any vitamin C, right? That's a problem. You know, if you're not eating any meat at all and you're getting zero B12 in your diet, like that's a problem.
Absolutely.
And so I think that, but people still, you know, push those extreme ends when the reality is that either one of those on either end of the spectrum, like it's, you're going to end up with a nutritional deficiency at some point if you aren't diligent about what you're doing.
And that's the problem is most people aren't diligent. They like, they jump on the train.
They half-ass it.
Exactly. They don't do enough research. They don't plan anything out. They just think it's cool to eat nothing but meat. Just like when the keto diet was popular, you know, people half the time weren't even in ketosis. They were just eating a whole bunch of fatty foods they thought were delicious. And they were still eating way too much protein, way too many carbohydrates to actually be in ketosis. And what they were, and you know, inadvertently doing was clogging their arteries up, right? Yeah. And potentially leading to cardiovascular problems down the road. And that's my concern with the carnivore diet. So as somebody that's a huge hunter and, you know, I believe in animal agriculture that's responsible, like locally, beef, chickens, ducks, right? Like humans have been doing that forever. And meat is such a great source. It's the best source of complete protein, hands down. But to think that you should eat nothing but meat is just bizarre to me because anybody that uses an argument that says, oh, well, like if we look at this tribe or this group of humans that have survived on this and like one, like we talked about kind of before the podcast started, I'd be hard pressed if you could find me one example of a tribe that is in existence today that eats only meat.
Yeah.
Right. Cause we talked about the Inuits up in Northern Alaska, but their diet is really high in fat. It's almost like a ketosis diet. Also, they have high risk or high rates of cardiovascular disease. So it's not a great example if that was the one you were going to use to support that diet. The other one I can think of would be like the Comanche Indians back in the day that lived almost exclusively on buffalo, but they also forage for fruits and no one has great health data on them, but their fertility rates in the Comanches were very low, which is why they kidnapped a ton of people and included them in their own tribe, which was badass. Love the Comanches. The point I'm getting at is that you can find an example to support any diet. You can find a testimonial of an individual that's alive right now that it worked for, like, oh, I fasted for 30 days and it cured cancer. I did the keto diet and it cured cancer. Or I did this and it cured cancer. Like just because it happened for one person doesn't mean it applies to everybody. And that's where you have to get human clinical trials, randomized controlled trials, and yes, epidemiological studies. I do not shit on epidemiology whatsoever. I think it is a great starting point. I think you can get a lot of valuable data from large groups of humans. Of course, like any research, there's always flaws and downsides, right? Like, oh, but you can't potentially account for all the factors, yada, yada, yada. But you can get some pretty good ideas and trends, right? So,
And we were talking about like, so the everybody gives, you know, that Instagram guy, I'm not going to say his name because, but there, you know, there's this one Instagram doc who loves to talk about the carnivore diet, but he wasn't actually the creator of the carnivore diet. So I was actually doing some research on this a few weeks ago. And so the original writer of the carnivore diet, his name is actually Dr. Sean Baker. Interestingly, I found out, I kind of Googled him, right? And did some research on him. I didn't. And supposedly at one point in his career, like 2017, he actually got his medical license revoked. And the reason he got his medical license revoked was because he wasn't found to be competent to actually practice medicine. And supposedly he did get it back eventually. But even what's his face on Instagram, he's not even a medical doctor. He's a psychiatrist. And he's
getting, I did not know that.
He's a psychiatrist. Yeah.
The internet thing. Or you know what? Yeah. Once, because since you're consulting the Oracle as we speak, I've heard this, but I actually don't think I ever looked it up. I am under the impression that the creator of the Atkins diet died of a cardiovascular.
He did. Let's confirm this. I'm like 99% sure that he did. Yes. So, oh, this is interesting. I didn't realize this, but Carnivore MD himself, oh, I just name dropped him. He's a psychiatrist out of Seattle, Washington.
Oh, he's your neighbor.
He is my neighbor. Hopefully, he doesn't come knocking
Oh.
on my door. It's all right. He can't get here. All right. All
Just
right.
the Atkins diet
Oh,
created him
yeah.
if he died of a cardiovascular incident.
So, the Atkins creator, Dr. Robert Atkins, and then in 2003, he slipped on an icy sidewalk outside of his New York office, hit his head, and then never woke up.
Whoa, didn't see that one coming.
So yeah, he actually had a heart attack the year before he died, and then he fell, hit his head, and died.
Yeah, it's just crazy. You know, and just so I don't lose my train of thought here, because somebody that I really respect in social media, former Green Beret Mike Glover, love what he's doing out there. But he made a post, and I think he reposted an article from CNN that talked about the risk of doing the ketogenic diet wrong. And like in his explanation, you know, there's this like belief.
I understand the need for individuals to have to create boundaries for themselves, but at the end of the day, the diets are all doing the same thing in terms of weight loss, right? If you eat like a dump truck and you're just eating garbage all day long,
And not moving.
If I can go in through the drive-through 3 times a day and then sitting behind your desk all day long and then sitting on your couch all night, and then
Right.
you go to eating whole food, less calories overall, and you actually end up doing even something as simple as walking, and you're
Right.
starting obese to begin with, you're probably going to see a positive effect there, right?
Without a
And
doubt.
yeah, absolutely. And all the benefits that they're touting that these diets do can be seen if you just simply use, any other diet that creates calorie deficit and helps you lose fat and visceral fat, right? So yeah, I'm not a huge fan of it. I will tell you, like, the one thing just in practice that I've learned is, like, a lot of the personalities I work with, like, they're just gonna do whatever the fuck they want to do anyway, So like, my job as a dietitian is, like, I'm gonna educate this individual on how the body actually works and the pros and cons, right? Oftentimes there's a lot more cons, but at the end of the day, I mean, they're going to choose to do what they want.
For sure.
So I think it, like, the thing with I think the thing that people have to consider, just like with everything, is you have to take it into the context of your life. If you're a sedentary, overweight person who sits at a desk all day long, your carbohydrate intake doesn't need to be as high as somebody who trains once or twice a day and has a very physically demanding job, or is prepping for a marathon or a backcountry hunt, right?
Yeah.
But again, it's like this thing, it's like all or nothing. And this is really common in the tactical community too. This is like, it's like, I'm either going to do it not at all, or it's just going to be like full fucking send. And let's not deny the fact that, like, if these guys, like, they're putting shit out on Instagram, like, anything that's going to be extreme or create conflict or get somebody emotionally stirred up, like, even what we're talking about now, right? Like, they're like, people are probably going to be like, oh, I've been on carnivore for 10 years. And I'm like, okay, great, show me your LDL cholesterol, because that's the thing about it, right? Like, you want to tell me, like, there's benefits to what you're doing in terms of weight loss? Great, I believe you that you've lost weight if you're doing that diet, because your cells are probably starving. But if you want to show me your blood panel, right? Like, let's have a discussion about that, right? We
For
talked
sure.
about that earlier. What Say what you said earlier to me about that guy's blood panel.
Yeah. So, like, when I heard Paul Saladino or whatever his name is, the carnivore MD guy, called him out again, Mr. Seattle, the LDL was like in the 500s. But the thing is, with the carnivore group, is that they don't believe that LDL is a good biomarker for cardiovascular, events. And there are a ton of caveats, right? Like, what density LDL are we talking about? This and that.
Particle
But
size, particle number, what does your homocysteine levels look like? What's your total
absolutely.
cholesterol to LDL? What's your HDL look like? Like, how much physical activity you get? What's your job?
Yeah,
Right?
there's
Like, there's tons
so
of
many
factors.
factors. But all I can say is,
But
and it should
bro,
be,
500, 500.
yeah,
Come on. You're gonna
it's
tell
so
me
out of whack.
that out of that 500, you have no dense LDL particles in there. Like, come on.
Well, that's what I'm saying. And I think if you just think about it intuitively, if you eat too much of anything, one thing, it's probably not great for you.
Yeah.
Right? Like the argument for sugar, for sure. Like if you eat too much sugar, it's not going to be good for you. If you eat too much salt, it's mm-hmm. not going to be good for you. Like all yeah. of these things, you can drink you can overhydrate yourself, become hyponatremic and kill yourself
yeah.
from drinking too much water.
Which oh God, don't say that because now people are going to stop drinking water.
You still, trust me, it'd be really hard. I had rhabdo, I drank a shit ton of water. But
it
is possible.
Oh, we have to talk about that. All right.
So I did a 30K, I had a 50K trail race in Wyoming coming up in like 2 weeks after my rhabdo incident. So the 2 weeks prior, I did a 30K trail race with my friend. We just signed up for a local one just to like test our nutrition plan, like mm-hmm. test all of our gear, kind of just have some fun, get like the race environment, get all hyped up. And that event went really well. My buddy and I crushed it. And as soon as I got home, it was like 90 degrees here, super humid. I just busted straight into yard work. And I did yard work till the sun went down. Sunday, did yard work till the sun went down all day. So my body, and I've been trained for running, so like it wasn't mass damage to my legs, but my body was just tired and probably not as hydrated as it should have been. And then Monday was Memorial Day, so I went into Murph. And I have not been strength training at my baseline, which I normally do, because I do Murph every single year. I mean, not that I ever have like an impressive score.
I don't even call it Murph anymore. I just call it Rhabdo Day.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah. But like I've had so many people just come across and be like, oh yeah, I got Rhabdo. And like that time of year, I'm like, you did Murph, huh? And they're like, yeah. Because they don't train for it.
Right.
Right. And so like, especially within the military, it's like, you know, somebody's squad leader thought it would be a good idea to just get everybody to do Murph, regardless mm-hmm. of fitness level. Right. And then, you know, two or three guys come in and they've got rhabdo.
Absolutely. Well, and it's like, I should have known better because, you know my body's limits, but I had done Murph every year in the past. And what really got me is like halfway through the workout, I knew I should have stopped because I was doing it with the vest. I was going straight through like 100 pull-ups.
You're an infantryman. Like, you're not going to stop.
Well, that's exactly my fucking problem is I don't have like the word quit is just not an option. I was like, I will literally die here. If I'll fucking yeah. die on the spot doing this workout because I'm not going to quit. And then it turns out I almost actually did die after the workout, which like would defeat the purpose of why I even work out anymore. Like
yeah.
my whole game is like to stay as healthy as possible for as long as possible so I can elk hunt and snowboard and do all the things I enjoy up until I'm like fucking 80. So yeah. me getting rhabdo was a big wake up call to listen to my body. But yeah, essentially I just went into it unrested. I mean, I was rested, but not as rested as I should have been. And yeah. And then after the Murph day, I did a whole solar panel day out in the sun, 12 hours physical labor. And I seriously, I couldn't even straighten my arms out because I was so fucked up.
Yeah.
But I just fought through the whole day. I literally said to myself, this is going to sound so lame. And some of the viewers are going to give me shit for this. But I said to myself in my head, I was like, you're a fucking Marine. Suck it the fuck up. Because I was like, I got to tell them, like, I should stop. But I was like, nope, that ain't me, dog. That ain't me. And then I pissed blood.
That's so typical. Yeah. Yeah. Key indicator that something's going on with the kidneys.
When your piss looks like Coke, it is not good.
Because it wasn't the arms being locked into place, right? It was peeing blood.
So, you know, it's tough because like I've been super sore after workouts, like my entire career exercising. Yeah. Like there's just been super hard workouts where you're like, oh, I'm so sore. But I should have known from that level of soreness that it was like next level. Cause I mean, it was like, I was like rigor mortis, you know? And I'm like, yeah. That's not good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll forgive you. Well, like all make mistakes.
Well, now I went twice, then I'm really an idiot. But like the first time, I'm like, that's kind of all right. You learn.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. What was your, and so like when, what kind of walk us through like what happened? Like, obviously like you were stiff, right? And then you're peeing blood and then you took yourself to the hospital.
Yeah, so I work at a hospital, so I mm-hmm. was going into work when I pissed blood. So, like, I had my scrubs on, you know, I took a leak, and I was like, oh, shit. So I told my wife, I was like, hey, I'm going to eat before I, like, do my shift today. She's like, why? I was like, I pissed blood. She's like, all shocked. She's like, what? I was like, yeah. So then I go to the hospital. I, like, go to the ER, and I'm like, I have rhabdo for sure. And they're like, how do you know? I was like, I can't move my forearms, and I'm pissing blood. They're like, oh, okay. So, like, they had me piss in a cup. They took labs right away. Sure enough, like blood in the urine confirmed like high amount or like fair amount. And then my CK level, my CPK yeah. level was super yeah. elevated. It was at like 90,000. And the doctor was like not expecting that.
Yeah.
Because they don't and deal with like, yeah. And I, like I said, I'm an idiot. So Now, hopefully I'm smarter after that. But like, I obviously, like, I got back to training as soon as possible. And that's one thing, they didn't really have good advice to give me in terms of like what my return to training was. Cause I had that 50K 2 weeks after. And I was like, I want to still run this 50K. And the doctor was like, I think I should say no, but I'm not sure. So like that gave me encouragement. I was like, okay, I think I'm definitely going to run this 50K still. And then I reached out to a couple of people on social media. And if they're listening, thank you very much. I really appreciate your advice. And they're basically like, 4 weeks, don't do it. Chill. Just yeah. Don't do anything. Let your body recover. And so like prior to rhabdo, I could bust out a set of 20 pull-ups, no problem. Post rhabdo, I can now do like 4 pull-ups. Like wow. My strength and my lats is gone, diminished. It is awful. So I am like, it's a long road to recovery in terms of, I mean, luckily my running's at baseline and that's what I'm competing in now anyways. Mm-hmm. Like those are all the events coming up, is all running. But I got to build my upper body strength up. I mean, it just got devastated.
Yeah.
So counterproductive.
Yeah. And I think people don't think about that. They think, oh, like I'm better. I got clear from my doctor. Like I'm just going to pick up where I left off of. But there's, you have to ramp up back to baseline before you start taking on more work. And I think that's where a lot of people get in trouble too.
I get it. Cause I'm an active person. So to be inactive is like the worst thing in the world for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we've kind of like killed a couple of topics to death. So we need to save some fodder for a later episode.
Yes, thanks for having me. And it's great catching up with you. And I know we'll stay in touch. So no worries there. But
thanks for sharing your life story and your rhabdo story with us.
I'm an open book. Happy. So, you know, no secrets here.
All right, Eric. Awesome. We'll talk soon.
Yeah.